Okay, we do have some people to testify on 427, but I'd like to start it out with Senator Pat Rohde, if he's back in town today. I'm not sure.
You're on somewhere.
Senator Duncan has joined us at the table. He will be up here in just a minute. And after we take Senator Rohde's testimony, what we'll do is take the people that are on the list here. Mr. Sullivan, Bob Sullivan, and then that's the only one I have on the calendar here. Someone else want to testify? Bob Mintz or? Okay. We're just taking it easy until we get Senator Rohde up here. Because we're just... He has joined us in the room, and Senator Rohde, did you want to come forward and you can start out on the bill? I know your committee's worked real hard on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief because we do have people from AHFC that can really provide the committee with more detail than I can about how the bill actually operates as a mechanism of corporate direction. The bill, as I think everyone is aware, does a number of things. The first and perhaps the most important thing is the ratchet down. It's clear that we can in the future no longer afford the subsidy. There is a several-year ratchet down provision. This one was carefully drafted in consultation with the financial advisors of AHFC, including most importantly the bond houses and the bond rating houses, who determine the cost of AHFC's money. And the proposal that you see embodied in the bill is the result of the best thinking of all of those people, and that's important because it ensures that we'll get the absolute lowest cost of money and not face any kind of increase that will be passed on to the consumer in Alaska. The bill does several other things that members of the committee are also familiar with. It exempts the AHFC from the Procurement Act and from the Executive Budget Act, not unlike the Alaska Railroad. It's difficult to understate the importance of these two provisions. The Executive Budget Act provision has cost the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, has cost the public between 20 and 80 million, $100 million, $20 and $80 million, because they were unable to respond to the changes in their structure of property ownership when the value of real property fell. A vast number of foreclosures were had. There were not the people to deal with it. The corporation couldn't respond adequately. As a consequence, the corporation, hence the public, lost a great deal of money. I won't take any more of your time. The gentlemen that are here to testify after me can provide a great deal more detail on how this bill impacts the corporation. I would recommend the bill to the committee. I think it's a responsible way to deal with AHFC, a responsible way to terminate the subsidy in its present form, and a responsible way for the corporation to do business in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rohde, there are a couple questions for you. Let me make sure I understand the subsidy buy-down or the subsidy reduction that's in it. It's my understanding that we go with a phase down from 90,000 down to 70 and after a certain period of time, then from 70 to 50, then from 50 to 30?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Over a 4 or 5 year period?
4.
Okay, I understand that. I want to make sure I understand the Executive Budget Act and the exemption from it, too, if you could address that.
The language is identical to the language that is used to exempt the Alaska Railroad from the Executive Budget Act. In fact, the amendment places the AHFC next to the Alaska Railroad in that language.
Okay, they wouldn't have to come back for the legislature for approval on their budget or anything, then, would they? Would they? No?
They would not come through the normal process. They would, like the Alaska Railroad, be subject, of course, to any overview that the legislature would require. AHFC has more complete reporting requirements than any other quasi-governmental corporation, and I know because I wrote those into law a number of years ago. Every facet of their organization and of their finances are reported to the legislature every year by law. And the Executive Budget Act prevents them from dealing with any kind of problems except on a yearly basis when they come before the legislature. The difficulty of that is when we have the kind of market that we have today, that that slow response can cost the public many millions of dollars.
Okay, let's go to questions. And I saw it was Senator Frank, Senator Pierce, and then Senator Binkley. Is there off to Juvenile? Okay, in that order.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rohde, on the 30, you said that comes down to 30,000, the subsidy comes down to 30,000. Does it stay at that level?
Yes, for the low-income program, on the low-income.
But not for
the general program. No, sir.
Okay, it phases out totally after that fifth year or whenever it is. Okay, then, how does the corporation define low and moderate as shown there on page 3 in the low and moderate program? I'm just wondering how that's defined.
I can't give you all the details. There are specific criteria which change from time to time, but are essentially the same defining income. And I'd like to have Mr. Sullivan answer that question and give you a far more detailed answer than I can.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rohde, in Section 9, you are now exempting the board of the Alaska Railroad Corporation from even having to adopt procedures on procurement that would be anywhere close to the procedures that are in law for the rest of the state. Why have you done that?
In Section 9?
That's on page 7.
Yes.
Line 11.
Now, why is that in this bill, the
page
AHFC
7?
Bill? Page 7, Section 9.
Yes. That ties in with the other section on and that's the definition section, and it ties in with the other language with that relates to the exemption.
Mm-hmm. You're not exempting the ASHA. You're just exempting the Alaska Railroad. That's a new section just for the Alaska Railroad with a title amendment that speaks just to the Alaska Railroad.
It is in the title of the front of the bill. I did
yes.
see that, so.
Next to last line of the title.
I may be reading up. My apologies, I'm reading the wrong bill.
Oh, okay.
That's my. That ties in, I'm sorry it took this long, I was reading the unabridged version, the earlier version. And your question was why the Alaska State Housing Authority?
No, my question is why you added a host section that further exempts the Alaska Railroad Corporation and doesn't do anything to the Alaska State Housing Authority. It stays as presently written. All you're doing in this Section 9 is exempting the Alaska Railroad Corporation from one more requirement that they have in terms of the procedures code. procurement clause?
I don't think, through the chair, I don't think that's the operative effect of the section. I'd have to have Mr. Chenoweth answer why ASHA wasn't deleted in Section 9, even though it is mentioned in Section 10. The operative effect is to provide that the list of corporations, which is the university, ASHA, the railroad, and AHFC, shall adopt substantially equivalent procedures. Why it was drafted that way, quite frankly, I'd have to have Mr. Chenoweth explain to the committee. And I will run that down for you.
Senator Binkley had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rohde, being a good student of the Constitution and very familiar with that, I'd like to ask you about the provisions of Article 9, Section 12 of the Constitution that speaks to the budget and reads, "The governor shall submit to the legislature at a time fixed by law a budget for the next fiscal year setting forth all the proposed expenditures and anticipated income of all departments, offices, and agencies of the state." Wouldn't that include AHFC?
I don't have a copy of the original legal thing that was done some years ago, but for a number of years, the language of the Constitution has not precluded the Executive Budget Act not applying to the university or ASHA, or the most recent addition was the railroad. And I don't have an answer off the top of my head, Mr. Chairman.
The Executive Budget Act doesn't apply to the university?
In terms of the agency, they have a different, that's not a good example. They have a separate constitutional provision for the university, so that's not a good example. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the procurement, I was looking at the Procurement Act section.
By the Constitution?
Or the university is. By law. I mean, we can exempt people by law.
Well, I think that's in violation of the Constitution. The Constitution says that all departments, offices, and agencies of the state.
Of course, we didn't have an Executive Budget Act until 1970.
We do have a member of the railroad here now, too.
That's the question, but we really didn't pass
the Constitution in 1970.
Yeah, but we didn't have an Executive Budget Act.
But anyway, Mr. Chairman, I can go on with that. Irrespective of the constitutional argument on the issue, we do every year in the budget itself, in the front section, give AHFC broad-ranging latitude in how they want to spend the money. We basically say in Section 14, all unrestricted mortgage loan interest payments and all other receipts, including without limitation mortgage loan commitment fees, received by or accrued to AHFC during the period of July 1 to June 30th, 1990, and all income earned on assets of the corporation during that period are appropriated to the Alaska Housing Finance Revolving Fund for the purposes described in AS 1856, which basically allows them to spend the money as they wish. I don't think it's too much to ask them to come to the legislature every year, be proud of the budget that they've produced, present it to us, allow us to sprinkle holy water on it, so to speak, and have them go forth. But even though they have the ability to really spend it as they want anyhow, that division in the front section.
Well, there's a question of whether they do or not. What's happened in the past is if there's any glitch in the system on either side, and there has been in the past, they're deprived positions. And as a consequence, when you have several thousand pieces of foreclosed property that belong to the public, and someone cuts their positions, and they can't deal with those problems. And it's been a problem in my constituency, and Senator Franks, and Senator Duncan, Senator Pierce, Senator Ewing. It hasn't had the same impact for Senator Zaroff and for yourself. It has involved a tremendous loss because there weren't the people to deal with the problems as they occurred. And they weren't really set up to be an agency for the ownership of property. They were set up as a secondary bank. And it requires, and one of the old adages in banking is that the banks are not suited for the long-term ownership of property where they manage it themselves. And that's what AHFC has been thrust into. Without the people to take care of that property, as a consequence, there's been a tremendous losses because those people could not be hired by AHFC. And there was some politics played several years ago, and I should call on Senator Fakes, one of the former chairman of this committee, to give you in graphic detail what happened and what was absolutely contrary to the public interest. And my concern isn't so much with the Executive Budget Act, it's with allowing AHFC to have the people to respond to the changes in the economy, particularly those changes that jeopardize tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of public money.
My point is that they do have that flexibility.
I would yield to the judgment of the chairman of the board of AHFC, but it's my understanding that they do not have that that flexibility.
Well, Pat, Senator Rohde, wouldn't they, if the bill passed as it was, they wouldn't have to come back to the legislature and at all, would they? In other words, would there be a requirement that they have to be put in the front section of the budget as we do now? I mean, in other words, they wouldn't be coming to the legislature. They wouldn't be coming down here talking to us.
We wouldn't hear from them.
We wouldn't hear from them. We would just let them sort of run their business as they do. And how would we ever get our investment back from them at some point in the future, infinity, or at some point further down?
Well, of course, the legislature can always, always make laws affecting them. And I defer that question to. To Mr. Mintz, the chairman of the board, as to the precise nature of oversight, because I really am not competent to talk on that question.
Are there other questions from Senator Zaroff? Had a question, I thought.
Let's try
and
that.
Then Senator Frank.
I was just wondering what the effects were of Section 3 and Section 5 having the delayed effective date until 1992. Quite possible
of Section 3 and
Section 5.
And Section 5?
According to the chairman, according to the effective date, these sections do not become effective until July 1 of 1992.
Again, I'd like Mr. Mintz to speak to that question, but it's part of the ratchet down format.
In other words,
we can tell you exactly how that interplays with those portions that become effective in 1990.
Senator Frank,
excuse me, not on that. Do we want to go on to, or back to the other? Is that all right to go ahead and go back? On the Executive Budget Act, I share the concern about taking it out of the Executive Budget Act, and I appreciate the desire of the corporation to be able to move with some degree of flexibility on hiring and adjusting to certain changed circumstances. But I'm not convinced that they don't have adequate flexibility with the current situation. In between budget cycles, it's my impression that they can go before the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to ask for approval of additional positions. Even if the Budget and Audit Committee doesn't approve those additional positions, they can, if they have the support of the governor, they can put them in place 45 days later and just notifying the legislature. So I think they have the flexibility, and I think we heard testimony in was either Housing and Banking or Banking and Economic Development or one other committee, I'm not sure, from perhaps it was CNRA, from Merle Jensen, I think it is, from the legislative budget and audit shop, and I'd like to hear from them again, because it was my recollection that he testified that they had, in fact, received their requests over the years. And if we have a political problem, if we have a certain senator, a certain House member that's holding a committee hostage, or holding a bill hostage, or a budget hostage, then the rest of the legislature ought to rise up and not let that happen. And if we failed in that in the past, that's a failing of the legislature. And I don't think we should change our system just because we failed by letting some certain senator jerk HFC around on their budget. I didn't know it was happening. I would have been happy to stand up and say something about it, do what I could to bring it to the attention of the public and the press. But I don't think we can. I just feel uncomfortable in creating a public corporation and setting it outside the review, the annual review of the legislative budget process. And I appreciate the desire of the corporation. I know they're acting in good faith, but I still think that it is important that we have that oversight, limited as it may be.
What I would suggest, if that's the feeling of the committee, and I know Senator Frank and I have talked with this, and Senator Frank makes reference to some testimony that was had before the Banking Committee, mm-hmm. is allow AHFC to have to put on the positions and then come to budget and audit. I sit on budget and audit, and we have trouble getting a quorum in the summertime because we are a part-time legislature and all of us work.
Yes.
And there, especially when Senator Cotullo holds them in out-of-the-way places, it's very difficult to get a quorum. So we can go by for 3 or 4 months or more without a quorum. And I would suggest that in those cases that giving AHFC the authority to put people put those people on and then come to budget and audit would be a responsible compromise. Also, based on that, I'd suggest we put everybody else in the budget, Executive Budget Act that's out now, the railroad and everybody else. Might be a good thing for the community to do.
Wouldn't bother me.
Yeah.
Senator Binkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what Senator Roney was referring to was in FY89 when the AHFC had come before budget and audit with a request for, I don't remember how many more
70 positions. 73 positions.
Positions, and I think Representative Larson was chairman at that time. They tried to have a meeting in the fall, couldn't get a quorum. It wasn't dealt with until late in the session, actually, as I recall. And that did cause some problems for AHFC. In that year, in FY89, we had put the same language basically in the front section of the budget for AHFC. However, we had put the caveat that they had to come before budget and audit with any changes to their budget, even though ultimately the administration could override that. We did have them come before budget and audit in the past. In fiscal year 90, that section that I just read from, we deleted the reference to budget and audit. So now they don't even have to come to budget and audit. They can make those changes unilaterally without the blessing of even the Budget and Audit Committee. So it seems to me we've solved that problem at this point.
Okay. I'd like to have, through the chair, the best person to respond to that. That's not my understanding, Senator, and the best person to respond would be Mr. Mintz, of the chairman of the board.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and listen to have Mr. Mintz come up. I don't know if you planned on testifying this morning, but we'd sure like to hear from him.
I suspect he did. And I will also get an answer, Senator Zaroff, to your question on the effective dates, Senator Pierce, to your question with regard.
Now, Mr. Sullivan is here, too, and I know we want to talk to him. Do you mind if Mr. Mintz goes first? Okay. Mr. Mintz and then Mr. Sullivan on the schedule this morning. And I thank you for being so patient through capital punishment and everything else this morning.
Senator Ewing, Senators, we support the bill. I know the question of the Executive Budget Act exemption has come up, and it's my understanding, Senator Binkley, that although I agree with your observations regarding the language in the front of the budget and the history about how it was changed, it's still not clear that AHFC has the ability to respond to changes in its business needs. There's a provision in Alaska Statute 3707080D which creates some ambiguity when read with the Budget Act language that you referred to. And speaking for the corporation, our intent and our need is basically as follows. When loan volume goes up, we need to be able to put on more underwriters. When REO sales go up, we need to be able to put on more property disposition people. When MGIC or other mortgage insurers start adding new requirements to us that will jeopardize our ability to successfully assert our claims, we need to be able to put on claims processing people. And if we can find a vehicle for allowing us the latitude to accomplish those business objectives, I think that that will satisfy the needs of the corporation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, philosophically, I agree with Senator Frank that I think it's a useful exercise for HFC to come to the legislature and for us to deal with their budget. And I think this language gives them the latitude that they need. And there was a problem in the instance in FY89 with those 70-plus new positions that they wanted to institute. But aside from that, I don't think there have been many problems that I've been made aware of anyhow. Seems to me it's a problem. It's not a something that's broken that needs to be fixed.
Mr. Mintz, there was another question by Senator Pierce, and I don't know if that you'd be the person to answer it. I see you also have someone here from the railroad. On page, section 9, page 7, line 11, why was there an inclusion in there for the railroad? You don't know?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's not of our doing.
Someone should know. Mr. Powell, Larry? Larry, did you want to, could you come up and answer that question and then we get that out of the way so the committee understands that reasoning and all that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. My name is Larry Howell. I'm a department manager with the railroad. However, I serve as a legislative liaison for the corporation in Juneau. That particular set of language is was an amendment to the bill, I believe, or Senator Fakes helped us out with that, and it's our desire to go back to the original intent of AS 4240, which is our enabling legislation, which states that the railroad corporation must have a procurement program which is consistent with railroad industry standards. And in 87 or 88, the railroad was effectively taken out. That language was amended, and we now fall under the state procurement code.
Right.
And it inhibits our ability to be competitive in the marketplace dramatically. So it was language that was tacked onto this bill.
Just real quickly, Larry, and then I'll go to Senator Pierce. Larry, wasn't there a bill last year that gave you an exemption, a bill that went through state affairs that gave you an exemption from procurement? And did that bill not pass?
The bill did not pass, Mr. Chairman. The bill might have passed. However, that exemption did not work. We got hung up on language, and I wasn't here then, but the language said that the railroad procurement practices must be substantially equivalent to. And most lay people read that as not equal to, but substantially equivalent to. However, our legal people say that that's the same as. So effectively, we are in the state procurement code, which costs us $200,000 to $400,000 a year to participate in that type of practice.
Senator Pierce?
So you're exempt from the code, but what we have said in statute is that you have to adopt procedures substantially equivalent to the procedures. So you're exempt, but you're saying that doesn't mean anything because your attorney said it's substantially equivalent to is a...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pierce, the original AS 4240 language, our enabling legislation, says that we must adopt procedures that are consistent with industry standards. The State Procurement Act, the substantially equivalent language, effectively does not allow us to be that way. That amended it in such a manner that we fall under the State Procurement Code, and I believe it's the Attorney General's Office, too, has also said that that is that substantial equivalent language does in fact put us back into the state procurement practices. So we feel as though we are under the state procurement guidelines and as a result have adjusted our operating procedures to accommodate those state procurement practices, which takes away a lot of our responsiveness to the marketplace.
On the question, Senator Pierce and then Senator Frank.
Well, I guess if that's true in Section 9, then we're not doing anything for ASHA either. The Alaska State Housing Authority, and we certainly haven't had them come forward and complain that substantially equivalent to is costing them money.
Senator Frank.
Mr. Chairman, to me, it kind of calls into question the whole procurement code, what are its purposes, what are its costs, and that sort of thing. And if the Railroad Corporation says it's spending $300,000 or $400,000 to comply with this code, I would like to ask for a detailed description of those costs so that we could understand them better. I don't doubt that they exist. I think perhaps one difference would be you have an apartment in the administration, and they come to us every year, and we fund their budget. And if it costs them $5 million more to comply with the procurement code, that's just the way it is. And they ask us for that $5 million, and it's all buried in there, and we don't question it. I think the Railroad Corporation is really trying to do a good job of cutting costs, running it efficiently, and that sort of thing. They know they can't come back to the legislature for additional monies, and so they're looking at ways to cut costs that perhaps the executive agencies are not. So I think that they're before us with this request out of a desire and a need to cut their operating budget and make it more efficiently. And I think it might prove insightful to our entire procurement code. So again, I would ask them to give us some information on that detailed breakdown. I know one thing that comes to my mind is the need to advertise, even for a small procurement, is very costly. It may cost you $10,000 to advertise for a $5,000 procurement, which of course doesn't make much sense. So these kinds of things are things that I think would be helpful to the legislature in dealing with a whole broad issue. I think we should probably take a look at that whole issue. If we have public policy, it seems to me the reasons for having a procurement code are so that we know that our executives, our administrators are procuring in a fair manner, in an honest manner, in a manner that lets the contracting public have easy access and fair access to doing business with the state. That seems to be the public policy reasons for having it. But we should also understand what that costs and make sure that the costs and the benefits are equal or at least justified. And perhaps there are things that we could change so that it wouldn't cost us so much.
Senator Rohde, do you want to make a comment?
If I could clear up something that just occurred to me, that the language in here that presently the railroad is under the procurement, under the requirement they have substantially similar procedures to the procurement code. Senator Fakes made an amendment in the Banking Committee that would change that, and on page 9, the language of adopt the public procedures to govern the procurement supply services instruction by the corporation. That language was put in there by Senator Fakes because the present language, in her opinion, and I believe in the opinion of the attorneys for the railroad, requires essentially that they use the Procurement Act. Senator Fakes is the author of the Procurement Act, and it is not without some problems. I'm chairman of Judiciary when it was introduced and spent a great deal of time working on it. Perhaps I worked a third of the problems out, maybe not that many. But there are problems with the Procurement Act. That's the source of this amendment. It was put in committee. It was not in the original bill, and that was the intent of that amendment.
Larry, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to address Senator Frank's concerns and her comments. As far as to quantify the numbers, clearly we can quantify that being in the State Procurement Act does in fact add 2 full-time staff people that do not contribute to the bottom line. But in the sense that it is there for administrative purposes for paperwork. Now that's a little over $100,000. The difference is that the State Procurement Code in our mind is not, market opportunity is not a consideration of the procurement code. The State Procurement Code is there to oversee the administration of funds, whereas the Railroad Corporation operates on a self-sustaining basis and we are bottom line oriented, which is a measurable thing. I have an example, if this would not be out of order, that I can show you where we can, why the procurement code does not allow us to respond to the marketplace. And it's in a letter from
Barry.
It's a very brief example here, Mr. Chairman. And that's why I want to reiterate that the market opportunity is what is lost, and that's what would be very difficult for us to quantify. And you can see the date on the letter that I've highlighted is January 4th, 1990. Now, this particular example deals with coal hopper cars. The railroad in Alaska is a very small railroad. We cannot go out into the marketplace and really buy things and really buy things at a competitive price. So what we have to do is effectively piggyback on the big railroads outside. 70% of our procurement of railroad materials is in the lower 48, simply because railroad industry manufacturers are located out there for market reasons. So what we have to do, we get opportunities like this. Now, these cars, for what it's worth here, will not accommodate Wishbone Hill. This is a different type of car, but this is a good example. On January 4th, we received a letter. And in order to get the $44,500 price for this particular hopper car, we must respond by January 26th. So you see, we cannot do that under the state procurement practices. If we were operating consistent with industry standards, we in fact could respond and we could pick up this bargain price. This run, by the way, is about for 500 cars, and they happen to have 85 cars left available for us to procure. So that's the difficult thing that we would have to quantify. And in order to fulfill Mr. Frank's request.
Well, Larry, why are we buying more cars when we just tried to sell some cars in regard to the Delta Barley project and those hopper cars that they had with them?
Okay, the Mr. Chairman, the hopper cars, first of all, the railroad never owned those cars. They were owned by the state of Alaska. And that title never transferred to the Railroad Corporation. Is what I should say.
So we're just selling the cars for the state then?
We're selling the cars for the state to retire a debt. The state of Alaska, the Barley Project, leased a lot of land from the railroad and built these silos, and the state of Alaska went into arrears on that rent. So in order to retire the lease, we've said we will sell the cars and retire the lease and buy out that lease program. But those hopper cars will not hold coal. Those have fiberglass linings, and they would not hold the coal. They hold grain and other types of products.
Great. Senator Benkert.
Let me make sure I understand this. The state is in arrears on the lease to the Alaska Railroad?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Binkley, not anymore at this time, but the state did refuse to pay the rents. I was the director of real estate at that time, and on the grain silo operation in Seward on railroad land, the state of Alaska discontinued payments on the lease, and we actually, if a normal tenant, a private sector person, we would go through the court judicial process to procure those rents. State of Alaska would not pay. We worked a deal with DNR where we would take the grain cars, broker the grain cars, and effectively retire the lease.
Senator Bingley.
Why was the state, did they dispute the amount? Or could they not afford to pay it, or why didn't we pay our rent?
When I received the lease was a long-term lease that was entered into, and I believe there was a project in the office of the governor dealing with the grain project. And that department was totally eliminated. And in fact, I got the bill and I didn't know where to send it, so I sent it to the governor. And the governor's people called, Mr. Howell, what do we do with this bill? I said, you pay it. They decided not to pay, and as a result, we pursued a negotiated settlement with Department of Natural Resources, who acted in very good faith, and we've resolved that issue. It is behind us. But the state has gone into arrears on several railroad leases.
Okay, Senator Benkert, one more question. We are getting off the
subject. Yeah, we are. I apologize for that, Mr. Chairman.
But cars are gone.
$44,500 for coal hopper cars. Why is this so much different than the Wishbone Hill cars?
Okay, this is a different type of car, and that's the
coal. They still hold coal,
but there's different requirements dealing with. And I am certainly not into the coal car business, Mr. Binkley, but the $44,500 price is to a specific car, and Wishbone Hill would require a different kind of car, maybe a different shaker mechanism for the type and the size of the coal. I don't know, sir. But there is a difference in coal cars. They all are not all the same. If we were to procure just 85 coal cars without this, what I referred to as a piggyback effect by going on with another larger railroad, we would probably pay 20% more. It's the danger here, sir, is in using this as an example for the Wishbone Hill coal car price. It is not, we are not looking, this is not an apple that we're using at Wishbone Hill, sir. This is a different type of car.
Well, we appreciate the information. I'm sure this will come up again when we deal with the Wishbone Hill issue.
Okay, any other questions for Larry? Senator Frank, can you make it?
I just wanted to ask him if he would try to send us back a letter with quantifiable, you know, with the breakdown of those, including what you told us, and
I'll do,
give us a best estimate.
I will do the best I can, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, if Mr. Mintz, would you stay at the table, and we'll also take testimony then from Mr. Sullivan.
Senator Frank? Question to Mr. Mintz.
Senator Frank, why don't we go ahead and take Bob Sullivan's testimony, because he's been waiting patiently here for the through capital punishment and everything else. You know. Hi, good morning, Bob. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Sullivan, and I'm mortgage operations officer with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And I think my testimony can be exceedingly brief in view of the preceding speakers. And that is, the bill as presented to you this morning is supported by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation in its entirety, very frankly. But I would add one caveat up front so that we all understand precisely why I'm going to say what I'm going to say. I cannot comment on anything pertaining to the Alaska Railroad in this bill. I have no knowledge of it. But in terms of operation of the corporation, we do believe that this bill, as presented, will allow us to do the things in a timely manner that need to be done, and it will allow us certain other latitudes, if you will, not without responsibilities, however, that we feel that are necessary in order to conduct our corporation in a business-like manner, Mr. Chairman. And I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Senator Steve Frank.
Thank you. Mr. Sullivan, the Railroad Corporation has estimated, and they're going to provide me with a letter quantifying a $300,000 to $400,000 cost to the procurement. I'm wondering if you could do the same type of thing. Try to. I know it's a little inexact, and I know that you know it may be difficult to, you know, to give any real degree of exactness or whatever the right word would be there. But could you try to quantify? Give us not examples. All the examples that you can think of, and to try to quantify them so that we'll better understand the problems that the procurement code causes for you. I personally, of the two, the Executive Budget Act and the procurement code, I am more persuaded that the procurement code causes you greater flexibility problems than the Executive Budget Act, and I'm more sympathetic to exempting you from that procurement code. But I, as an aside, or perhaps part of the total discussion, I'm interested in how that procurement code works for you or works against your operations.
Senator Frank certainly will make every effort to comply with your request, but it's going to be an inexact thing, obviously.
I understand.
And I would hope that you would accept this as our best estimate, if you will.
I will, because the only thing that we have to go now on is anecdotal kinds of evidence and, you know, some good anecdotes, some good examples. But I would like to try to quantify that, because we do have to compare, you know, the costs versus the benefits of this thing. And some people, I'd have to say most people that I've talked to say the procurement code has been a disaster. You know, it's been a problem. It's been this and been that. But I have to admit also that I've talked with some vendors that like the new procurement code, feel they're getting a fair chance at state business under the procurement code. So I think there probably are some advantages to the procurement code for the vending public out there. I'd like to try to get a better handle on whether the costs, or the benefits rather, compensate us for this cost.
I would comment, if I may, Senator Frank, in this regard. Obviously, I'm proud of where I work, and the statement I'm about to make may get me in trouble. However, I think that in the state of Alaska, there are very few agencies, if any, that have the high visibility that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has in the public eye. Mm-hmm. And as a result of this, quite frankly, everything we do within or without the budget code, if you will, is obviously subject to scrutiny by many thousands of people who, I might add, are not necessarily silent on comment or thought or action. So it will certainly not be to our advantage to do anything that even has a hint of being out of the ordinary or that is not responsive to small businesses or small purveyors, if you will.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, with all due respect, I can tell you that, you know, probably 70% of the realtors in my town are mad at the HFC, have been mad at the HFC for the way they have disposed of real estate in the last 2-3 years. And, you know, and the HFC has been trying to grapple with this for some time, and now they've gone from a situation where they had one designated broker, or maybe they had two, and then they got in a lawsuit with one. There's all kinds of problems, and I happen to think that HFC is trying to do a good job, but I'm not convinced that they should just be cut loose to go out and do things the way they want to without some kind of review, because it is a public agency. And I think that you know, things are probably better now or less people are squawking, maybe because it's been spread out and there's more designated brokers or. Didn't perceive HFC's conduct as being open and fair and efficient and all those kinds of things that we would hope. That's the way I view it. So it's one of the inherent problems in doing private type business with a public corporation. It's you know, it has its detractions or it has, yes, its problems.
Senator Rohde.
On the executive budget act, to respond to Senator Mankey's question, there's a conflict between the language in the front of the budget in Title 37, and it's unclear which takes precedence, though as a lawyer, I would have to argue that it's highly likely that the statutory language, the executive budget act, would take precedence. I'm sorry, I didn't have that answer.
Okay, so what does that mean, Senator Binkley?
Well, Mr. Chairman, are you referring to 3707080D? As Mr. Minsk did?
Yeah.
I mean, there it states, can expend money or incur obligations except in accordance with law and properly approved operations plan. And in accordance with law, I mean, that budget act that we pass with that language in the budget is by law.
It's
the same thing that when we pass a budget that, as we did 2 or 3 years ago, that went over the statutory spending limit. I mean, our excuse then was, well, the budget is the law. And we could supersede existing law by simply passing the budget, which negates that existing statute.
Senator Rohde.
I understand, but I still feel that there's a conflict between the two, and the easiest way is to deal with the Executive Budget Act question, though I would yield to Mrs. Howard and the Governor's office on that point.
Okay, let's see if we can. Let's finish up with the testimony at the table. Mr. Sullivan, did you have any other further testimony?
No, I do not, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very much, and you're excused then from the table. Thank you.
I have one more question to Mr. Mintz.
Senator Frank, we will be able to continue with some of the questions with Mr. Mintz, but let's make sure. You had a request, Senator Frank, to have the gentleman from Budget and Audit come forth and testify?
Yes, I did, Mr.
Okay. Can we have that person come forward, Mr. Merrill Jensen? Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. You're going to shed some light on this for us this morning, Mr. Jensen?
Hopefully, Mr. Chairman. I'm Merrill Jensen, Budget Audit Division. When Senate Bill 427 was first introduced, our two main concerns were exemption from the procurement code, which was the primary one. And then the second was the Executive Budget Act. The procurement code, I guess in general, I would like to say that just so you know where we come from, we would like to see everybody under the procurement code, all quasi-corporations. We'd like to see everybody under the Executive Budget Act. But the problem with the original, and also the committee substitute, Senate Bill 427, as far as the procurement goes, it basically excluded HFC from the code without any requirement to place them under any kind of competitive purchasing principles, unlike the railroad and unlike the University of Alaska, which basically has to, their law also states that they have to be substantially equivalent to the state procurement code. That was our main concern with the procurement code, the fact that they're basically the door is being open. The concern we had with the Executive Budget Act, I guess our real concern was the way that the Budget and Audit Committee seemed to be blamed for holding up 74 positions for a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. Over the last 3 years, the Budget and Audit Committee's approved over 105 positions through the RFP process. I guess my comment in general is when an agency comes before a committee and asks to double their staff, I think the horses are already out of the corral. We know as a fact that, and I'm not speaking about the present administration or the present organization at HFC, I'm talking mainly about the prior one, but we know as a fact that the staff recommended 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I can't remember, 44 new positions, and the executive director came to the LB&A committee with a request for like 25. So I think a lot of it was the lack of timeliness on the way of the former HFC management rather than the untimeliness that the Budget and Audit Committee seems to be blamed with in that particular study that came out. But again, I think there's enough flexibility in the Executive Budget Act, and certainly I think when you get back to the procurement code, our procurement code has been worked over and over and over. I believe it's a model code of other states. It provides for flexibility. You have exemptions in the code. You have emergency provisions in the code where the chief procurement officer is allowed to make exceptions in purchasing practices when it can be demonstrated that it's in the best interest of the state. And when these quasi-corporations keep coming before us, or you people, and saying that it lacks the flexibility of being competitive and being this and being that, I kind of agree with Senator Fakes. I'd like to see it too. Certainly, there's all examples. There's specific examples. One thing I think the legislature should be concerned about is everybody knows that HFC and everybody knows that the railroad are public corporations. They're Alaska corporations. And I think it's imperative, it's very important that the purchasing, the perspective of the public is that we have fair and competitive purchasing going on in these entities.
Are there any questions? Senator Frank?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Merle, do you think that the case that was cited here by the railroad could be handled with the existing code through the special features in it that would allow emergency procurement or blah, 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 that sort of thing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fakes, Senator Frank. I think it could be. I'm not familiar with it, but a good person to ask that would be Bob Link, the chief procurement officer for the state. I think that flexibility could, if there are special situations, I think that flexibility could be built into the court. Of course, it would take, have to take an amendment on the legislature's part. But we have been doing several audits over the past year and a half on the procurement code. And an example is that we, or one example is that we went into the railroad, looked at what they were doing. And I think this was an impetus of the introduction to the bill last year, is that we found that they weren't substantially equivalent to the code. And we had some disagreements, and all of a sudden the bill showed up last year. But I really think that there's enough flexibility built into it. Like I said, I believe that Bob Link, the chief procurement officer, could certainly answer that question a lot better than I could.
Okay. Could I ask another question there, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frank?
Thank you. Appreciate your indulgence this morning. Could you give us a better understanding of the process that currently exists for an agency to come before the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee? My understanding is first they'd have to go to OMB to get an increase in staff between budget cycles. They would have to go to OMB and get the governor's approval or the governor's Office of Management and Budget approval, and then go before the LBNA, and that if the LBNA doesn't provide that within 45 days, then they could go ahead and do it anyway. Have I got that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That's my understanding. Barring the recent discussion here with Senator Rohde and the apparent confliction between what the statute states and what the Appropriation Act this last year, I don't know, Mr. Greeny might be able to shed some light on that too, but overall, that's my impression of how it's worked, or it should be working.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to run out of time here, Senator Frank.
I just wanted to make point that if that was in fact the case, and if HFC maintains that the 45-day period is too long a wait for them to have enough flexibility, perhaps we could look at that particular provision to see if there isn't a way of providing a little bit greater flexibility while not exempting it from the Executive Budget Act.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Binkley.
Mr. Chairman, I have several, but I know we are running out of time here. Are you anticipating holding this bill over?
Well, Senator Frank, I was going to say we could, there's a couple issues here. I want to know, first of all, if there's any more people that want to testify on the bill before we go any further. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on 427? Senate Bill 427. No one else? Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Mintz? Senator Frank?
Yes. I was going to ask Mr. Mintz about the definition of low and moderate. Senator Rohde was deferring to you.
Well, that's my question, too, Mr. Chairman, but I don't know if we're going to continue on with this bill or are we going to...
Well, I think my thinking was I'd like to get the bill passed out. Although I understand there are some concerns on it, and I'd like to know what those concerns are.
I think the biggest concerns are exempting them from the Executive Budget Act.
Well, I knew that would be one that was going to come up. Senator Pierce?
And I continue to be concerned about the railroad exemption from the Procurement Act. I'm not persuaded on the, because of one letter and some railroad cars, which we apparently don't need because they're not the right kind of cars, that we should do that exemption.
Senator Rohde had some kind of a time factor in getting the bill passed, so I guess he's left now. Is he not? Is he there? Okay. Well, anyway, Senator Frank, did you have some concerns, too?
I have the concerns on the Executive Budget Act.
Okay. Perhaps you could work on those concerns between now and tomorrow so we can get on with the other things on the schedule. And let me see if there's any other questions that Mr. Mintz can answer. Mr. Mintz, you're going to be here today, so if you could go around and see people on their questions, that would be very helpful. Okay, we'll hold that over then. Thursday will be the next day we can bring it up because we have a presentation tomorrow starting at 9 o'clock. So that's why I brought it up to the committee. We have still some concerns on it. We have to get those solved before we pass the bill up. Okay.
Otherwise, it was a good
Chairman,
meeting this morning. Senator, did you...
We did not hear from the administration on this bill. And I see Mary Halloran sitting there, and I was wondering, I would like to know if...
I asked three times if anybody wanted to testify on 427. If the governor does not wish to testify on it, then that's his prerogative. He knows the process. Mary Halloran?
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could do that in subcommittee.
Fine.
Could you, Mary, do you support the bill or not? Can you just say that and then...
Yes, we do.
You do support it. Okay, then will you talk to the subcommittee people between today and tomorrow? Okay. Thursday. Senator Frank and Pearson Bink, they'll be working on that. Today and Thursday. Okay, thank you. Next bill on the calendar is Senate Joint Resolution 62.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Binkley.
This relates to the bycatch of herring in the Bering Sea groundfish trawl fishery. We are looking at an impending crisis in really many of the western Alaska communities, Dutch Harbor all the way up to Norton Sound, as a result of the trawlers in the course of their fishing for pollock and other fish catching herring in that process, and it's potentially going to devastate the commercial fishery in many of the areas in western Alaska, and even potentially the subsistence fishery. And this resolution speaks to that and is addressed to those who can actually do something about it, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. Also, Senator Zaroff has offered an amendment that I have before me. I don't know if... Do members have that amendment?
It should be in the packet.
There's an amendment.
In the packet.
Page 2, line 7?
Yeah, yes. And I have no objection to the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
This isn't going to cost us any more money, is it, sir?
It'll save us money.
Senator Zaroff...
We'll make money off of this one.
That's right. You want to adopt the... you want to add this to it?
Move your amendment.
I would move the amendment.
Is there objection to the moving the amendment for committee substitutes for sponsor substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 62?
I'll talk to you about this later.
Okay. Now to be finance version.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
move it.
I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent to move out with individual recommendations. Committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Joint Resolution number 62, finance.
No objection, so ordered. Next bill on the calendar is an act relating to health care providers to report cases of fetal alcohol syndrome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This was heard by the HES committee prior to this.
Anybody here to testify on that bill?
I think, Mr. Chairman, if I could just, there is a proposed committee substitute. There was testimony in the Health and Social Services Committee from primarily, I think, the ACLU. They were concerned about the fact that in the reporting requirement was the name of the child and the address of the child that did have fetal alcohol syndrome. They felt that somehow could be used at some future date if the state passed a law that made it illegal to harm the fetus, and that they could go back and prosecute. They could find out who the mother was through the child's name and address and somehow prosecute the mother. That wasn't the intent of the legislation. I don't ever imagine that happening, but there is no real reason for the reporting of fetal alcohol syndrome to the Department of Health and Social Services to have the name and the address of the child that's affected. And so we did remove that section. There was an earlier committee substitute a draft, and I don't know, the department may have seen that one, and I know they were concerned with it, and we went back and made some changes that would have eliminated the reporting requirement of many of the communicable diseases that are now required to be reported to eliminate the names of the individuals. And we went back and made that change to conform with the wishes of the Department of Health and Social Services. So I believe this version they do now support. And hopefully the ACLU, or whatever that's worth, also supports it.
Okay, do you want to adopt the committee substitute?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill number 408, Finance.
Okay, any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, there is a small fiscal note, $5,000 apparently. The costs associated with the reporting, the computerization of the data, analysis, communication, mailing, forms and the legislative report duplication.
There is someone that wants to testify on the bill? I don't have you signed in, so I apologize.
Senator Ewing, Senators, my name is Catherine Kelly, and I'm the Division Director for Public Health. I am not sure at this point whether we have the latest version of the bill. We did have discussion with Senator Binkley's office yesterday. Mainly my concern in wanting to share my thoughts with you today had to do with the language in the CS that was in direct contradiction to the regulations that we have for infectious disease reporting, because basically the way that the last version that I saw was written, that would have totally inundated our whole infectious disease reporting system. Until I've had a chance to see this latest update, I'm not so sure that I could...
You make sure you get the... She's got a copy there.
One that says HR.
Okay.
See, the one that you've got.
The one that we have is the one that came over yesterday afternoon.
Yeah, that was E.
Yeah. So this is a new version.
Correct.
Okay.
Solve that problem.
All right. That was our major concern, and I think that moving FAS into the section that deals with impairment is wise, because there was a major conflict with trying to look at a condition along with other infectious diseases. It simply didn't make any sense, and it was causing us enormous problems. So at this point, I think we probably can support this to some degree, although we still have some concerns about the relevancy of the data and how difficult it's going to be without identifiers to avoid things like duplications, a child coming on over and over again as it's seen by different providers. So the validity of the registry still may be a problem for you in the future. We won't be able to make a lot of intelligent decisions based on a registry that we can't track back to somebody. There will be some errors in it.
Okay, Senator Pierce and Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess while we are not reporting the name of the child and the name of the mother, we're giving the birth date, the sex and the race of the child, and while I know that we have a grave problem in Alaska, I would think, and geographical area of residence, I understand that changes, but I it just would seem amazing to me that we're going to have two children born June 15th, 1990, both males, both Caucasian, where you're going to have the problem of double reporting.
It certainly could come up, especially in situations where children who are at risk are born, are brought in and born at, say, the Alaska Native Health Hospital or Providence or something like that, where we have large numbers of births in just a few areas. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the ANHS hospital, they keep statistics on fetal alcohol syndrome children. They have excellent statistics for the native population in Alaska, so I don't think that there would be any duplication in that regard.
Senator Pierce? Senator Fisher?
I have a question on that. There's a baby born with an infectious disease. Do you have regulations that require a physician to say, notify somebody?
There is a listing of all the infectious diseases that the state tracks, if you will, that are called reportable diseases. And the section of epidemiology is notified when those diseases show up upon testing or examination. And the decision is made at the time of the report whether there would be an active follow-up on the case or whether it would simply be just enumerated as a statistic for the state. It really depends on the magnitude of the problem and whether there is a need to go forward with it.
And these diseases would be preventable?
Yes. Yeah. And the intent is to for all communicable diseases is to identify the individual with the disease and to get treatment and intervention there as quickly as possible with the idea of containment and stopping the spread of the disease. Fetal alcohol syndrome is not that kind of a disease.
Just a little off of that, a little going, but in the case of an abortion, if it can be shown that the abortion fetus has an infectious disease, do you make any effort then to notify the mother so she can?
That would be a difficult call to make because in a lot of cases of abortion, the pathology simply isn't done to determine whether there was a disease or not. Now, there may be on record the fact that the mother had an infectious disease that may have caused a spontaneous abortion. That would be reported.
Okay, then if it's reported, since it's communicable also, do you make an effort to try to get treatment out to that person? So that
if it's treatable, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Banklet.
Mr. Chairman, there's no further question. I'd like to move out with individual recommendations. Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 408, Finance, with the accompanying fiscal note.
Okay. Any objections? So ordered. That's as far as we'll be able to get today, and Senator Frank is working on his bill. Did you have... Can we deal with the first thing on Thursday morning? Okay. These two bills we'll put up first thing on Thursday morning as the first two items on the calendar. Senator Zara, Cambridge Energy Research will have an expert from Oslo, Norway, and also from Cambridge, one on double hull tankers, the other on oil pricing for the 1990s, where our budget's going to go.
I'm not going to be here Thursday.
You will not be here Thursday?
Mr. Chairman,
you won't be here.
Mr. Chairman, we have our guy from the Department of Labor here on that bill. I don't know if anybody has any questions. I don't mind holding it over, but if there aren't any questions, maybe we could move it out.
Which bill?
My bill.
The boiler bill.
The boiler bill.
We're out of time. Well, Zaroff's got some questions on it.
Fred's got problems with it?
Okay.
Not with yours.
I think yours is a good bill.
We're going to have to adjourn. We're running out of time. We're going to have to adjourn the meeting. We'll have to deal with it on Thursday. Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started this morning and apologize for having started a quarter after. But we had a meeting until 9, and I was also trying to get other members. Those present today, is Wednesday, March 14th. Senator Fisher, Senator Duncan, Senator Frank are present. And we're expecting the other three people at some time soon. Today we're going to have a briefing and update on the oil market and where we're going. And we do have two people from the Cambridge Energy Research Associates who are here in Juneau to give us an update on it with expertises in two different areas. I'll introduce to the committee Kevin Lindemuir, who's on the left, who's the Associate Director of oil markets, and Mr. Lindemuir's responsibilities include upstream and downstream oil market research, and he specializes in forecasting and analysis of petroleum product markets. He is from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mr. Odd Hassel is a senior consultant and coordinator of tanker markets and strategy from Oslo, Norway, and Mr. Hassel is an expert on the world tanker industry, oil movements, and energy economics. He has broad experience in strategic energy planning, information systems, and oil and coal markets. And again, Mr. Hassel heads the Cambridge Energy Research's office and is a representative in Oslo, Norway. Why don't we go ahead and get started. Mr. Lindemuir, Kevin, did you want to start the presentation?
Senator Ewing, very happy to be here based on past experience of some of our fellow SERA employees of trying to get here to Alaska. Everything worked very well this time. Todd Hassel and I arrived surprisingly from two different ends of the globe within 10 minutes of each other. I took a local flight up from Seattle with a couple of stops in Ketchikan and Sitka, and I understand this is by design because of the great pie in Sitka. So I'm supposed to stop off and sit down on the way back and have some pie. We see the world oil market right now and lead into a new era of stability. Structurally, the oil market is poised to move upward. Most of the constraints, the downward constraints have been removed. We're coming into an era where there are capacity constraints at nearly every level of the oil energy business, tankers, production, refining, distribution. And also, OPEC has come to in a position where demand is growing strong enough for OPEC oil. Production in the U.S. market is declining, so the call on OPEC is increasing sufficiently that it is allowing them to deal with issues that have been very difficult to deal with in the past. We think that this year, for 1990, we will see oil prices trend in the upper range of our oil price playing field, between $18 and $20 for the OPEC barrel, possibly a little bit higher than that out into the fourth quarter. We do think there will be some short-term weakness within the next month or so. Today, the OPEC barrel is about $18 per barrel, and WTI, for a reference for you, is about $2 above that at a little over $20 a barrel. And that differential will very likely widen as we move into the driving season and possibly out into the fourth quarter. It is not unrealistic to see, we don't think it's unrealistic to see WTI hitting $25 a barrel on a very short-term basis in the fourth quarter. Again, that would be dependent upon how well the distribution system works and weather. The new OPEC agreement is working. The new compromise that they have come to is two major factors, changing the reference price to a minimum reference price. And this is very important to me psychologically, especially for the have-nots in OPEC, those that do not have excess production capacity. That assures the producers with no excess production capacity that they at least will be assured of a minimum price, that the producers with extra capacity will try to control their production to guarantee a real price of about $18. Looking out a little further, we would see that about $18 real oil price is a very good possibility for the next couple of years. Nominal increases, unlikely there will be very much in the form of real price increases. Right now, the OPEC production is between 23 and 23 and a half million barrels a day. It's about a million and a half above quota, or about 1.3 above quota. This is being supported primarily by strong demand. We have had very strong demand in Europe and in the United States in the fourth quarter, and strong demand in Europe in the first quarter. Demand here has weakened in the United States, but that's primarily due to two factors. We have had warm weather in the lower 48 as well. We have had a situation with expectations of softer prices. Secondary and tertiary inventories have tended to be drawn down, which is reflected in lower demand, which does not mean lower consumption. The issue of quotas is something that OPEC has managed to deal with very effectively now. Instead of calling in quotas, it's minimum allowable output, or allowable output. Quotas were implemented in 1983, as you recall, to deal with falling prices. How do you divvy up a smaller pie? Well, now that's not the issue. The issue is how do you distribute increasing demand? And now it's becoming a situation where the five producers, the prime movers, as we call them, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iran, Iraq, Venezuela, and UAE off on the side as sort of a tag-along, they are the ones who have extra production capacity. The issue of maintaining price now is firmly on their shoulders. And they are the ones now who appear to be moving toward an environment much like the old Texas Railroad Commission used to do. They allocate excess production capacity to maintain a price. That appears to be the direction that they are moving in. This summer, we would expect that demand will pick up and continue to support price. So far, in the last 5 years, there has been a tremendous change in the way we look at the world. In the first 5 years of the 1980s, everything was down, consumption and price. That was, it was all bad news if you were an oil producer or a marketer. Demand was shrinking, and prices were falling. The situation has reversed dramatically in the last 5 years of the 1980s, particularly on the gamble of lowering oil prices to stimulate demand, and it has worked very well. In OECD North America, that is the U.S. and Canada, up almost 10% in the last 5 years of the 1980s. And by far, the most tremendous growth has been in the Far East. OECD Far East includes Japan, and also in the non-OECD, the developing countries at 21%. Granted, these volumes are relatively small when you look at the total for OECD Europe and in North America. But this is where the demand strength is going to come in the future. Demand for refined products is not going to support the price, not including the production. As a result, oil prices are going to be pulled up by demands from individual countries and primarily from the Far East and the developing world, not from North America. In North America, we see demand for 1990 only growing 0.5% this year. In Europe, up only 1.6%. But for the year, for the Far East and for the developing world, we can see demand ranging from 3.5% to over 4.5%. Clearly, the volume demand, OPEC, the major oil producers, will be looking to the Far East for incremental markets. The United States is going to be important because of continuing decline in production, but the Far East will be important because of new market opportunities. The question of economic growth enters into the demand picture. And we would expect that demand is actually going to, or economic growth is actually going to slow over the next year or so, particularly in North America and somewhat in the developing countries in the Far East. But somewhat as a rule of thumb, you can say that about 1.5% to 2% is going to equal, in economic growth, be about a 1% increase in oil demand. Here in North America and in Europe, that linking is much less than it is in the Far East and in Japan. However, we would say that on an average, this would hold true. As a result, I think you can imply here that we're looking at something less than 1.5% growth in the United States. For the United States demand picture this year, we would see little to no growth in gasoline demand. So there's going to be very little support coming from transportation, with the possible exception of diesel fuel and jet kerosene. In fact, as we look out further into the future, the environmental impact of cleaner burning gasoline, it may result in slight growth in gasoline demand, but that oil component of gasoline may actually be a little bit lower or falling. OPEC revenues are holding up very well. This year, 1990, we estimate that OPEC total revenues will exceed the level of the pre-1986 crash. This is not due to absolute dollar volume, but in the magnitude, the volume that they are now producing, up about 5 to 6 million barrels a day. And clearly, in real dollar value terms, the price of oil today is still less than it was in 1974 and 1975. However, in nominal terms, OPEC is definitely on the uptrack for revenues. The game continues between OPEC and non-OPEC, a market share game, and right now OPEC seems to be winning, albeit very slowly. We do see more non-OPEC oil coming on stream this year. Non-OPEC production will likely be up this year in the range of a couple of 100,000 barrels a day, maybe a lot of this is going to be a result of some developing countries. We have some new oil provinces really coming on, North Yemen, Syria, Vietnam, Australia. Looking out further, there are some newer ones coming on, Papua New Guinea. One thing that is very important to remember about this production that's coming online is that this is generally light sweet crude oil. And OPEC crude oil is generally heavy sour crude oil. In the environment, environmental issues right now are favoring the exploitation of these types of reserves over OPEC types of reserves. And when we look at what OPEC is going through in its capacity expansion plans, which I'll talk about in a couple of minutes, nearly all of their dollars right now are targeted toward developing the light sweet crude oil reserves that they have. These are like offshore Iran, eastern Venezuela, some relatively new provinces that come on. as well as Saudi Arabia. Some of you may have heard about some new discoveries that Saudi Arabia has been making in previously unexplored areas. They are finding North Sea quality crude oil, which is very, very different from anything they found before. It's right now, the preliminary estimates of the reserves in that province is roughly about 30 billion barrels. To give you an example, that's equivalent more than total of the United States recoverable reserves. And if you take North Sea, UK, and Norway times two, that's about what we're looking at. And again, this is a very good quality crude, about 40 gravity, less than 0.06% sulfur. So it's very good stuff. We look out toward next year, 1991. We believe the OPEC compromise is going to continue to hold. Also, that demand is going to continue to support prices. We think that prices are going to tend to trend toward the upper level of our playing field range. That is, above the $18 up into the $20 range. So looking out, we see really very little downside risk in terms of the price of oil for the next few years. Major uncertainties are going to be accommodating Iraq. It's one large uncertainty. Right now, Iraq's production capacity is about 3.8 million barrels a day. They export about 3.5. The difference, they need the extra 300,000 barrels a day internally. However, if they were to repair all of their export facilities that currently exist to the state they were in before the war, their export capacity would go up to 8 million barrels a day. And they are very actively pursuing increasing their production capacity. So they could be a force to be reckoned with in the next year or two. Into the 1990s, some of the major factors that we see that we should look at, energy demand, we would say, in the 80s, we looked at it as slow growth. And now we're saying the perceptions for the 90s are for stronger growth. But again, this stronger growth is going to be in the developing countries and in the Far East, not North America or OECD Europe. The demand growth is going to be broad across the barrel. Initially, it will be transportation demand and possibly resid for power generation. Non-OPEC production expected to flatten off this in the 1990s, although there is still potential for some growth in some areas, but again, being offset by declines in the United States. And OPEC quotas, I think this is going to become less, or we think it's going to become less and less of an issue in the next few years. In fact, the Kuwaiti oil minister is now calling for the elimination of quotas as soon as possible. Probably the biggest issue on everyone's mind right now is the issue of capacity. Is there enough capacity to meet growing demand? We think that OPEC will be able to add the necessary capacity, but it's not going to be ratable like the growth of demand, slow by jerks, if you will, which is going to result in some price volatility, particularly in the fourth quarter when we have stronger world oil demand. Remember, most mid-continent U.S. and California tend to operate countercyclically, so the world has strong demand in the fourth quarter. When we start running up against that 80 to 85% of capacity rule of thumb, where you would see prices move up. Secretary General Subroto has been saying that it's going to take about $60 billion in order to get another 6 million barrels a day of capacity in OPEC production. That, we think that's too high. But one thing Dr. Subroto was saying is including $15 billion in maintenance as a capital expenditure. That should be taken out. We think it's very likely that OPEC is going to be able to increase capacity by 1995 by 6 million barrels a day plus for much less than that, around $35 billion. How are they going to do that? Right now, we would say that these guys over here, Iran, Iraq, UAE, Algeria, they're looking at equity-based financing, inviting foreign oil companies in, either in a production sharing agreement or an equity swap of some kind. And many of these countries are being forced because of financial or foreign debt. There is no way that they can borrow more money to increase their production capacity. And I think very soon,
we think you can move Iraq and Venezuela over into that area as well. Saudi Arabia, on debt financing, they can do it. They do have a vehicle. If you've heard that you're talking with the Japanese of trying to get into the Japanese downstream market, the Japanese would like very much to get into the Saudi upstream market. The Japanese are demanding an equity share, and there is a vehicle for doing that, even though it is against Saudi policy. The Arabian Oil Company, which currently operates in the neutral zone, is 80% owned by the Japanese, and it could be a vehicle for working out a compromise. So foreign production or foreign monies is going to be necessary and will be and is being used to increase OPEC capacity, and we think that it will result in adequate increases. This is just a table to show what the expenditures by country and how much they could get. Indonesia is the only one that we think is likely pretty much tapped out as far as being able to increase very much. They would be short term, next year or two, and then probably falling from there. Another uncertainty going into the 1990s, I'm sure that is on everyone's mind, is what's happening with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, they've been able to maintain their exports, and they are making statements that indicate that they plan on maintaining exports to Western Europe at any cost that they can. However, they're very likely going to decrease their exports to Eastern Europe, which will force Eastern European economies out onto the Western oil markets. Another call on OPEC. Up to the year 2000, we don't think that there will be much of a change in Soviet exports to Western Europe. And if you've been looking in the newspapers at some of the statements of what the change to Eastern Europe should be, there is a bit of a confusion in the press. The press is quoting very often millions of tons of oil per year. And it looks like a very big number. But when you put it down into the way we think over here in barrels per day, it actually works out to about 200,000 barrels a day drop in exports. So it's really a relatively small number. And when you look at what the total demand in the Eastern economies are, about 1.7 million barrels a day, it is relatively small. But it's very important for them because they're going to be a large currency to exploit.
Which is good.
Through the 1990s, by far, the biggest issue is going to be the environment. And attached to a handout that you were given today is a summary of a survey that CIRA did in conjunction with Opinion Dynamics on the U.S. consumer or U.S. public's attitude toward the environment. It's a very important issue that cuts across all political lines. It cuts across all countries and all governments. In some way or another, nearly every government in the world appears to be green of some shade. Even the Iranians announced an environmental policy. This is something that OPEC really must look at. It's a ceiling on demand. If you increase oil prices too fast, the longer-term effects of fuel switching, energy efficiency, due to environmental and national security reasons, forces demand down. And in today's world, we're not resource constrained. We're infrastructure constrained. As I've been talking about in tankers, and I've been talking about in OPEC production capacity, but we look at our refining system. Our refining system is running at or near operable capacity for longer and longer periods of time. So we're infrastructure constrained. We have more oil, we know of more recoverable oil and gas reserves today than any other time in world history.